Back by popular demand, here are some of the best memes from r/philosophy memes for us to both laugh at and hopefully learn from. So, let's crack on. Right, first up we have a meme by Sage Magic, and it has two very attractive looking cartoons, and it's people who read philosophy, and then one guy who looks a little bit more down on his luck, and it simply reads philosophers. I think there is a fair amount of truth to this meme. If you go looking into the lives of philosophers, you'll often find that these are pretty unique or pretty troubled people, especially, you know, the big names, people like Kant or Socrates or Nietzsche or Schopenhauer. These are often quite troubled people or just quite unusual people. And to be totally fair to philosophy, this sort of goes for a great many fields, right? If you look into the lives of some great scientists, they often have incredibly weird habits, and it gets even more extreme in something like maths. I mean, the kind of schedule that someone like Paul Erdős or Gödel had. Objectively so strange and a little bit mental. And I think this somewhat comes with the territory of wanting to devote basically your entire life to quite an abstract pursuit in search of a great truth or a fundamental discovery. And I think this definitely goes for philosophers. Someone like Kant would just have the same daily routine in his hometown for basically his entire adult life, to the point where he's sort of known a bit as the town eccentric. Someone like Nietzsche would be passionately committed to the mountains and would retreat up into them for months on end and would withdraw himself from society and, you know, generally just didn't seem to have that good of a time. I mean, at least when you read about the life of Kant, it seems like he was having a vaguely good time being this sort of provincial Königsberg gentleman who just kind of, you know, muddied about in his daily life, but wrote some absolutely phenomenal philosophy. Whereas Nietzsche does come across like he is having just the worst time basically all of the time, and sort of reminds me of the bottom part of this meme here. By contrast, you meet people who read philosophy or do philosophy as a hobby, and they seem broadly quite nice. I mean, I'm very biased here, so I don't know if I can make a very good judgment on this. But, you know, whenever I meet a philosophy enthusiast, I'm pretty predisposed to like them, and they also seem, you know, relatively well put together. I think that, well, certainly when compared to some of the great philosophers. That being said, if you do meet actual modern-day philosophers at a modern university department, some of them are quite odd, but a lot of them are perfectly lovely people who are just very passionate about a particular area of philosophy or the history of philosophy and just want to share that and work on that. But in terms of kind of the great philosophers in history, they do tend to be a little bit strange. I mean, a really good example of this, I think, is Ludwig Wittgenstein, who just all of the stories about him are so bizarre. I mean, the man was completely off his rocker quite a lot of the time, alongside being an absolute genius. This was someone who would pace around a Bertrand Russell study, and Russell would kind of joke at him and say, you know, you're thinking about logic or your sins? And Ludwig Wittgenstein would kind of tense up and reply, oh, it's both. And there's one famous story of him sat at a meeting of the Moral Sciences Club, which is like the Cambridge Philosophy Society. And Karl Popper, another great name of 20th century philosophy, but a significantly more well-adjusted person, is giving a talk. And Wittgenstein is furious about it. And he really doesn't like Popper's general conclusions that he's arguing for, and he grabs the hot poker from the fire and brandishes it at Popper, at least according to some accounts, and tells him, give me one example of an unqualified moral truth, or something like that. I can't remember the exact quote. And Popper replies, don't threaten your visiting lecturers with hot pokers. And to this, Wittgenstein kind of throws it down and storms out. And I think he fell out with Russell over it as well. And, you know, this is somebody who is so passionately committed to philosophy that it gets them worked up emotionally in a way that for most people, philosophy just doesn't. You know, even people who are really into philosophy, it's not like if you were to tell them some kind of semi-ridiculous philosophical premise, or ridiculous to them at least, they would start threatening you with objects around the room. And Wittgenstein was just very, very passionately committed to philosophy in this way. And that led to some extremely erratic behavior. I think that, you know, for huge swathes of his life, he would also run off to a cabin in the mountain and just sort of be by himself and write his notes. And there was a point where he was a primary school teacher. God, I can't imagine Ludwig Wittgenstein being a primary school teacher. I mean, at this, you know, what a privilege, but at the same time, what a complete bloody nightmare that would be. I don't know any accounts of when he was a teacher, but if I were to imagine it, I think it would be awful. I mean, you know, this was a man who was frustrated with the intellectual levels of Cambridge professors. I could only imagine like a poor five-year-old looking up at him and being like, oh, Wittgenstein, here's my eight times tables, and then getting, you know, seven times eight wrong, and then Wittgenstein brandishing a hot poker at him. But, you know, on the flip side, you get to get taught by Wittgenstein. I mean, that sounds awesome. I'd love to have been taught by Wittgenstein, even though I think he would definitely leave my self-esteem in the absolute gutter. Next, we have a meme by Let's Go Wendigo, and it's logicians versus Gaston, and Gaston says, how can you read this? It's only equations. I think this is a fairly accurate representation of what a lot of more literary-minded philosophers think when first encountering mathematical logic. Mathematical logic was like my first love in philosophy, in a sense. I really enjoyed it. I did my master's thesis in logic about 2 days before my viva, which is the oral exam that you undergo for your thesis. I noticed a mistake in one of my proofs, and I was devastated. I was like, oh, they've definitely noticed. It wouldn't be the end of the world because, you know, it was a pretty simple thing to correct, but I remember thinking, oh, God, I'm such a moron, and I'm now going to get completely roasted. But they didn't notice. I was flabbergasted because it was really obvious. So maybe they thought it was so obvious that it kind of didn't bear talking about, and they would just dock some marks for it. Or they also did what I did when I was proofreading my thesis, which is skim over that particular proof because it looked a bit dull, and not realize that it contained a pretty serious mistake that undermined the structure of the proof. But anyway, if anyone at Cambridge is watching this, please don't take away my master's degree. However, despite this little hiccup in my relationship with logic, it has remained one of my great loves. It's a fascinating subject, and I do highly encourage people to at least learn the kind of basics of logic, because it will become more helpful than you can ever imagine. It just makes the world clearer. It's like understanding things in a higher definition. I don't mean that as kind of a point of bragging, because I think that actually that kind of higher definitional feeling comes with spending like 2 hours learning basic logical notations. But the effort to reward ratio of that is absurdly high. It will just click the world into focus in a whole host of ways. Unfortunately, I don't get to talk about formal or mathematical logic very much on the channel, just because it's quite a dry subject. It lends itself more to kind of math channels with lots of animations that I couldn't possibly code, or even channels that work around a whiteboard. Also, one of the things that I enjoy most about running this channel is the writing of the scripts. It's my favorite part by far. If there was one thing I could outsource to someone else, it would be this. It would be the presenting. I find this much more stressful. Whereas, you know, if I have a day where I can just go to a coffee shop and I can just write like loads, I love it. And to a certain extent, writing explanations of formal logical concepts, it doesn't allow that much wriggle room for artistry, I suppose, because you're valuing precision above everything else. And that's as it should be, right? Otherwise, you're going to distort the meaning of the maths. But it does mean that it takes a lot of the fun out of writing, at least for me personally. I do think that there's an art to writing good math textbooks, though. The book, A Friendly Introduction to Mathematical Logic, is phenomenal at this at an intermediate level. It motivates all its concepts really well and puts them in sort of a story that helps you understand why they're important and why they're relevant and why they may be worth learning, even if on the surface they seem pretty niche and kind of useless. And I promise that they're not useless, but you'll just have to take my word on that. But if you do want to learn more about logic, or indeed any other mathematical or scientific subject, then you should check out today's very kind sponsor, Brilliant. Everyone knows that learning subjects like maths or science can be incredibly difficult. These topics get very abstract and dense, and sometimes they can make you want to tear your hair out. But this is where Brilliant comes into play. They have courses on everything from programming with Python to classical mechanics to learning how AI language models work, each crafted by award-winning research teams. The best part is that with Brilliant, you learn by doing, making the information stick in your mind much more effectively. It's also just a great antidote to scrolling, since with their app, you can complete quick lessons or exercises on the go rather than getting lost in the quagmire of an internet argument or doom scrolling on social media. If you do fancy learning some logic, and I do highly recommend it, then you can check out the logic courses on Brilliant, which are fantastic tools for aiding your critical thinking and just seeing what logic is all about. A very dear friend of mine also wanted to let you know that the calculus puzzles on Brilliant are a lot of fun. To try everything that Brilliant has to offer for a full 30 days, visit brilliant.org/unsolicited advice or scan the QR code on screen. Or you can just click the link in the description, I don't mind which. you'll also get 20% off a premium annual subscription, so please do check this out. But anyway, back to the video. Okay, next we have a meme by Mr. Rizstein, and it's about Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, and it says, me before reading Marcus Aurelius, and it's someone sort of crumpled up on the floor looking pretty miserable, and then me while reading Marcus Aurelius, and then it's the story of going through the book. So it says, okay, I see, and then, all right, shit, he's kind of right, and then it's, F yeah, and renews gym membership. And at the end, it's, oh my God, I'm a changed man. I will only focus on things within my control from now on. And then it's him the next day, and he's in the same position, crumpled on the floor, incredibly miserable. Funnily enough, I think that Marcus Aurelius's Meditations is a very good book to make this point in, because one of the main critiques that it gets is that it's very repetitive. And it is, I will say that. Marcus Aurelius's Meditations kind of has four or five points in it, and he just keeps coming back to them over and over again and says them in sort of broadly different ways and approaches them from slightly different emotive angles and argumentative angles, but they are kind of, they are the same general positions being made. You know, they're about things like only caring about what's in your control and recognizing you're part of an intricate tapestry of different people and being patient with others and expressing gratitude. And it's all kind of stuff that you would associate with the Stoics and particularly Marcus Aurelius's brand of Stoicism, right? This isn't me having a go. You would expect him to largely focus on these points. But as a result, quite a lot of people read the Meditations and think, this is incredibly repetitive. Why is this such a classic work of philosophy? And I think that this meme actually illustrates why it is so repetitive. It's because you can't just learn a lesson about the world or about philosophy once and think, right, this will just filter straight into my life and I don't have to revisit it or habituate it or learn it again in any way. It can just sit in the back of my mind, safe in the knowledge that it's there, it's now going to be the ruling principle of my behavior, or it's going to be incorporated into the ruling principles of my behavior. And I just don't think this is how people work. I mean, I don't think that's particularly controversial. I mean, we've known this since at least Aristotle. One of Aristotle's points in Nicomachean Ethics is basically, contrary to Socrates and to Plato, who came before him, knowledge isn't sufficient for virtue. You also have to go out and habituate it and make it a part of your character and emotional framework as opposed to merely your cognitive one. And to a certain extent, this was seen as a point of conflict between Aristotle and the Stoics, because technically, the Stoics thought that knowledge itself was going to be sufficient for virtue. I talk about this in my video on Stoicism, right, where to know something just is to acquire that and have it in your map of the world and for it to become part of your behavior. But this also means the Stoics have a particular definition of knowledge where it implies behavior. So to a certain extent, I think the disagreement between these two schools of philosophy is slightly less deep than it's often thought to be. Because, you know, on the one hand, Aristotle is saying, well, knowledge is not enough. You've got to habituate this into your behavior through careful practice and reinforcement. And the Stoics are saying, if something hasn't filtered into your behavior, then you don't truly know it. And these just sound like using the word know in different ways, as opposed to there being a substantive disagreement about what knowledge is. And this sounds like, to a large extent, they are using the term know in very different ways. And as a result, I don't know to what extent you could call this a substantive disagreement about how to go about becoming virtuous and to what extent it is kind of a linguistic confusion. I don't know enough about either schools really to give a precise verdict on that. But for example, when Epictetus is talking about how it's not enough to simply rehearse the Stoic principles, you need to put them into your behavior and that's what constitutes knowledge of virtue, that's a really Aristotelian idea. It's just that Aristotle uses knowledge to mean what Epictetus means by kind of rote learning or general awareness. But also, yes, I think this meme does have a real point, but it is a point that philosophers have recognized. So if you're struggling to incorporate some philosophical principle into your life that you're very, very attached to or believe very strongly in, then give it some time and give it some practice. Or at least that's what Aristotle would say. And eventually, if you follow this Aristotelian line of thinking, the behavior will become so automatic and so natural to you that you will take pleasure in its enacting. So Aristotle talks about a series of levels at which you learn a philosophical principle or habituate a virtue. First of all, there's where you kind of consciously have to do it against your will. You know, if your natural tendency is to lose your temper and you're practicing being calm, then that will take effort. That'll be active effort. You're working against your habits. And then gradually, the resistance to this new behavior will decrease and it will become less and less trouble to remain calm in stressful situations. And then finally, it will bring you active pleasure to be the kind of person that is calm in a stressful situation. Or at least that's kind of roughly what Aristotle's line of thinking about habituation would be. Because he thinks that, you know, being virtuous is pleasurable. He just doesn't think, like the Stoics do, that it is sufficient for eudaimonia. He does think it's an important step on the way, though. But yes, if you're struggling with this, then please don't feel bad. It takes a lot of effort to habituate a philosophical principle. I fall short of my philosophical ideals literally every day. So yes, please don't beat yourself up about it. Or maybe I should beat myself up about it. It's got to be one of the two, otherwise I'm inconsistent. Right, next up we have a meme by ConfidenceDonut51, and it reads, "Most dead bodies are philosophers," and then it's a picture of Mr. Incredible looking pretty happy, and then it's Jeremy Bentham, and it's the skull tortured version of Mr. Incredible. God, it's actually quite disturbing to look at. But anyway, this is in reference to the fact that Jeremy Bentham's dead body is stored at University College London. I've actually seen it. It's quite a sight to behold. His head used to be stored at his feet, but students from UCL kept nicking it for pranks. So I don't know where it is now. I think it's in storage, or it wasn't there when I saw it anyway. So this is one of Jeremy Bentham's most eccentric requests, was that his body was to be preserved permanently after his death, to be a kind of like icon. Jeremy Bentham was one of the strangest men ever. People tend to know about the dead body thing, but he did a whole host of just completely weird shit. So he invented a walking stick that doubled as a flute. He had a series of pets that he like very seriously treated as if they were people, and just generally approached the world in an incredibly bizarre, unashamedly eccentric way. And you know, I can't help but respect that. I'm actually going to look this up. There's an article that UCL put out a few years ago on 10 things you didn't know about Jeremy Bentham. He's very much associated with UCL, but he's not actually its founder. He really argued for the kind of spreading of education amongst the general populace, and UCL was founded partly on that principle. So that's why he's at UCL. I don't know how they got hold of his body. Yeah, because he's there now. He's like mummified corpses there, which is so insane. Yeah, he's thought to have been one of the first joggers. And this was seen as insane at the time. This was seen as just incredibly odd. And he was still doing this in his 80s. You know, one of the first fun runners. And that sounds really cool. I don't know if Jeremy Bentham actually did invent fun running. He almost certainly didn't, because these things tend to get inflated over time. I would like to think that he was. He went to the University of Oxford at age 12 to study law, which, again, is just like, it's you know, he's kind of this child prodigy that also just was mad, but he was so brilliant that everyone put up with him. I know, I think it's really cool. I like learning about the eccentric lives of these old philosophers. Again, reference back to an earlier meme about philosophers resembling sort of tortured alcoholics. I don't think Jeremy Bentham was necessarily tortured, but he was odd enough that you definitely remember having a conversation with him. There must be some more. Okay, I've just had a bit more of a Google, just because I actually didn't know that much about this one. And this guy is mad. Like, he would journal all of his daily activities in incredible detail, and would make like charts and graphs of how well he's feeling. And he analyzed his day in 50-minute bits. That's awesome. I might start doing some of this. This is so cool. Maybe this will be like a good challenge. I mean, it won't go on the channel, but I quite often spend periods of my life attempting to live like particular philosophers or embody particular philosophies. And maybe I'll spend like 2 weeks living like Jeremy Bentham and see what happens to me. Because this is so cool and so fascinating. And I think that if I continue Googling this video is going to be several hours long. So I'm going to stop now and move on to the next meme. But yeah, what a man. Okay, next we have a meme by DapperSuggestion462, and it's of a monk meditating, and he initially thinks, "Wow, this is it, I finally killed my ego." And then he waits a bit and thinks, "I'm so much better than everyone else." I think there is a lot in this meme, and it's something that almost every spiritual tradition warns against. In Christianity, you have the notion of spiritual pride. This idea that you are holier than everyone else is itself a form of sin. It's not for you to say that you're holier than other people, it's for God to say. And the idea that God loves you more than he loves anyone else is a little bit egotistical. It's considered a little bit prideful. In Buddhism, they recognize this as well. They would say that this person is still attached to their ego implicitly through this idea that they are better than other people, even though they fooled themselves into letting go of their ego. I think the Buddha, or it might have been a later Buddhist thinker, does specifically identify this as an extreme impediment to achieving enlightenment, because it tricks you into thinking that you are further along the spiritual path than you actually are. And schools of philosophy that are trying to advocate for a particular total approach to life, like Stoicism, for example, do tend to have an analogous version of this warning. Epictetus warns against people who have simply memorized the Stoics and as a result think that they are now sages in and of themselves, and of people who fool themselves into thinking that they are further along the Stoic path than they actually are. And I think that all of these hit upon quite an important observation about we humans and how we go about our daily life and explore ideas. We do often overestimate the extent to which we have internalized and habituated these philosophical principles for everyday existence. I think we visited this a little bit with one of our earlier memes, but this meme builds upon the foundation of that meme by suggesting that not only can we trick ourselves into thinking that we are further along a particular philosophical path than we actually are, but that this is in itself an impediment to furthering our position upon that philosophical path. And I think there's quite a lot in that. You see a lot of this style of meme floating around the online Christian sphere, where it'll be someone making fun of themselves, saying that they're lecturing their incredibly pious and virtuous grandmother about the particular writings of some obscure second century saint or a kind of minor church father or something like that. And I think that these memes are pretty good to remind ourselves that maybe we think we're a bit cleverer and a bit wiser and a bit more developed than we actually are. And that sometimes it might benefit us to sit back and reflect upon all of those people who are wiser than us and know more than us and are cleverer than us, and just reconsider our place in relation to other people. We're probably not as top dogs as we sometimes trick ourselves into thinking we are. Next, we have a meme by Carla Pels, and it's Schopenhauer, and it says, "Me socializes, and then me for the next 3 months," and it's this Arthur Schopenhauer quote, "To live alone is the fate of all great souls." Unsurprisingly, philosophy is replete with quotes about solitude and finding a place to think your own thoughts and the connection between a certain degree of social remove and the ability to come up with ideas that are uncorrupted in their understanding by your wider society. And I think there is an element of truth to this, right? I think that if you are enmeshed in a particular community, you are going to inherit their views to a greater or lesser extent. Some philosophical schools have seen this as a strength. Epicurus recommended that Epicureans live together, and this is partly because they can remind one another of the shared wisdom of Epicureanism. However, I do like to give a counterpoint to this view, which is, if you are enmeshed in a community of not necessarily like-minded individuals, but individuals who are also interested in thinking about a particular issue very deeply, then you get to draw from their wisdom. When I was at university, I would surround myself with people who were just very inquisitive about the world and about their particular subjects, and a lot of them about philosophy. And I think I may have learned just as much from them as I did from my actual formal course and my actual formal education. So I do think that there are strengths to finding a community of people who are similarly passionate about thinking itself. But I think on the flip side, it's important that these don't become belief buddies, to use one of my favorite terms from Noretta Coerge, which is just when groups of people reinforce their own shared beliefs and don't subject them to any kind of critical thought or critical inquiry. It's important not to lose the vein of precise Socratic examination along the way. I also think that the valorization of isolation can often stem from resentment. I see this in people a fair amount, where because they might perhaps be struggling to find friends or find a community that they particularly gel with, they sort of reject people out of hand. I've definitely fallen into this in the past, by the way. This is by no means a criticism of those people. I only notice it because I know it's such a strong tendency in myself to say, oh, well, if you don't like me, then fine, I guess I'll just retreat into my philosophical tower and I'll pursue my studies as a lone, fearless seeker of wisdom. And I think, you know, there's something in that idea that solitude allows you time to reflect and study hard on a particular subject. But I also think that when I have expressed this, it has almost always had something to do with me actually feeling quite lonely and hurt at the time and attempting to justify that as something dignified to myself. by turning it on somebody else in a kind of fit of resentment. I think you see this a lot in Dostoevsky's Underground Man. I'm currently rereading Notes from the Underground for like the 8th time or something like that, because I'm writing a kind of full special hour-long video examining that text in particular. It was the video that kind of sparked my channel kind of starting to grow. But at that time, I was still making videos for particular students I was teaching. And that was no exception. One of my students had read Notes from the Underground or Notes from Underground and said, I don't really get this. And so all of my writing in that video is specifically geared towards this one person that I knew. And as a result, it doesn't really examine its wider or deeper themes, unfortunately. So I want to kind of remake a video on Notes from the Underground, really trying to pull out its depth. And I think I'm going to really enjoy that. I've started planning it, and I'll start writing it soon. But anyway, what I was going to say is that you see this in the protagonist of Notes from Underground basically constantly. He is quite often positioning himself as a lone intelligent person swimming in a sea of idiots. And it's pretty clear that if those supposed idiots showed him a modicum of love or affection, or he could somehow win them over to his side, make them his friends and band them together in a loving community, he would probably immediately drop his assessment that they're idiots and start praising them as noble and worthy people. And I do sometimes worry that the philosophical glamorization of isolation can tip into this camp. On the other hand, there is just the simple truth that people can be frustrating sometimes, and occasionally you do need to withdraw into your own space and your own mind for a little bit before venturing back out into the world. I would just encourage people not to stay there for too long. I think that one of the most pernicious things about isolation and extended isolation, speaking as someone who has sort of in the past spent kind of months basically seeing no one and kind of spending it in their own company, eventually it becomes scary to go outside. You sort of learn to treat the strangers that you encounter just on your walk to the shops as if they're going to be hostile, as if they're going to mean you harm, because you just haven't had any evidence that they're not. And you feel vulnerable because it's just you and you don't have anyone to necessarily reach out to in the area and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm a little bit more skeptical of the philosophical isolation than most people, because I think that A, it can often stem from resentment, and B, I think that being alone for a very, very long stretch of time can become this rather unpleasant cycle where you just fear the mere concept of other people. I should also say I'm absolutely fine now. Okay, next we have a meme by Sad Avocado, and it's the distracted boyfriend meme. And the distracted boyfriend is analytic philosophers, the rejected girlfriend is doing actual philosophy, and the person he is being distracted by is arguing about the definition of exists for 500 pages. So this is part of the general good-natured ribbing that goes on between continental and analytic philosophers. Analytic philosophers will often accuse continental philosophers of simply doing word salad and semi-expressing things rather than stating them clearly and articulately, and continental philosophers will often accuse analytic philosophers of ignoring the broader themes of life like love or meaning or community or being in favor of these particular definitional concerns or technical terminology within philosophy or precise logical rigor. And I think there is definitely some truth to both of these critiques. I do think that sometimes continental philosophers could stand to be perhaps a little bit more precise in their wording, but at the same time, there is a reason why most people are drawn to the more continental thinkers than the hardcore analytic ones. Funnily enough, I was the opposite. I loved and still love the logical rigor of analytic philosophy. And I will say a few words in defense of defining your terms with intense precision in the manner of a hardcore analytic philosopher. Because while it may seem like a waste of time at the time of writing, further down the line, when you're examining the detailed implications of your philosophy, it does really help to look back and see what the initial definitions of your terms are. And it also does really help misunderstandings. Imagine the number of arguments that you have with other people where you're just talking past one another because you're using the same term in different ways. And modern analytic philosophy is very good at avoiding doing that, because each person states their definitions very clearly, situates it in a particular historical context, and only then do they move on with their particular argument. So it's much easier to figure out exactly what people are meaning to say. Whereas, you know, you can read a paragraph of Heidegger and come away from it thinking, wow, there's probably something in this. I wonder if I'll ever figure out what it is. And I think that you could defend this from a certain perspective, right? You could analogize it to a koan in Zen Buddhism, which is a statement like, what's the sound of one hand clapping? Where the point is to meditate on it and reflect upon it and wrestle with it, and that this is in itself quite a good exercise. And sometimes there are philosophers where I take this approach to them a little bit. Some of Nietzsche's aphorisms where it's just one line of incredible richness, but not a lot of clarity as to what precisely he's trying to get at, does lend itself to this careful process of going away and reflecting upon it and maybe writing a little bit around it, and then returning with a renewed sense of what he might mean, but also more importantly, a sense of what you have understood by this particular aphorism. However, this is quite a painstaking and can be quite a frustrating process, particularly if you're trying to understand what this particular philosopher meant by this particular statement. That process is often a lot easier in the analytic school than the continental one. On the other hand, I do think that if you just focus on the questions that are popular within analytic philosophy circles, this can draw you away from examining concepts that have inherent vagueness to them. You know, things like love or passion or melancholy. These are, to a certain extent, quite individual experiences, and we use the same term to umbrella a variety of different feelings and, yeah, experiences. And this can mean that the search for a totally precise definition is always going to be a bit of a fool's errand. You're either going to cut out some of the richness of the concept you're studying, or you're just going to leave out so many people's experiences that you're now examining almost an entirely different thing or a specific subset of your initial topic. And there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes you do want to talk about experiences of love in general or experiences of melancholy in general. I think that a good rule of thumb is a variation on, I think, a quote by Richard Feynman. It's either Feynman or Einstein. It's a physicist who said, explain things as simply as you can, but no simpler, or put things in as simple terms as you can, but no simpler. I think that when I'm writing about continental philosophy or existential philosophy or dealing with these broader themes of human existence, I tend to follow the maxim, be as precise as you can, but no more precise than this. And I at least hope that this makes things clearer than they otherwise would be without pigeonholing these philosophers into saying less than they actually did, which I think is always a risk when you're taking someone like Camus or Sartre or Nietzsche or Heidegger, and you're attempting to boil everything they said down into a few key propositions. I think always something is going to be left out, but I try and leave as little out as possible as you can in like a half an hour YouTube video. But no, I'll leave it up to you to decide how fruitful an approach that is or how good I am at it. It's one I'm going to stick with for now. Okay, that's all the memes I have for you today. You can check out the rest of my casual videos here, and do let me know what other casual video ideas you'd like to see me do, because I do really enjoy filming them. It's nice to kind of speak in slightly more loose terms than I would do if I was doing a full scripted video. But anyway, thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.